Welcome to the Hypothalamic Amenorrhea Podcast. I'm Dani Sheriff, your host, certified fertility awareness practitioner, functional nutrition counselor, and founder of the HA Society, and of course, an HA recovery coach who has walked where you currently are walking. This is the place to come if you care about getting your period regularly. This podcast aims to educate, inform, and keep you motivated on your period and HA recovery track. So let's dive in. But last thing, nothing on the show should be taken as medical advice, so please seek the advice of your physician. Hey, are you trying to recover and maybe even fall pregnant naturally? I thought that might be you. And if so, we have created our best ever yet resource for you. Totally free. This is a masterclass. I've called it my masterclass because I have put everything into this, right? This masterclass is designed for you if you have HA or have had HA and are dealing with suboptimal cycles and you're serious about restoring those babies to full optimization and you want to create the ideal foundation for a pregnancy. This is going to be for you. So in this masterclass, I'm going to provide you a lot of things, including a lot of case studies, mine, Ashley's and Mishi's, as well as lots of our past clients and what their challenges were and what they had to do to overcome it. And we cover a really wide variety of types of cases of HA. So everything from primary amenorrhea and missing periods for years and years to short-term amenorrhea and what we did to handle that situation as well, and how long it took these people to go from HA to pregnant with this system, and how long it took them to go from HA to ovulating, of course, with this system. So lots of information, lots of case studies, lots of stats. We go through why this is not a weight gain plan and how we actually divide you into phases, the three phases of HA, and determine what your starting point is so that you have a good idea of where you need to start with your actual changes in lifestyle and nutrition changes. We even cover questions like HA and people with a normal BMI and recovery for people who have had HA for too long. There's so much in this 60-minute masterclass. Y'all, I'm impressed. And at the end, I'll also be running you through how to get a free HTMA, hair tissue mineral analysis through us, which is a part of our process for recovery and preconception clients that we're happily going to give you for free $99. As a massive thank you, of course, for joining the masterclass. So go to thehasociety.com/masterclass or head to our website and you'll find a link for it and find when the next available presentation is going to be. That's thehasociety.com/masterclass.
Salut, moi c'est Mélanie et vous écoutez le podcast Hypothalamic Amenorrhea.
Hey guys, welcome back to the Hypothalamic Amenorrhea Podcast. It's me, Dani, and we have a special guest for the first time in however many episodes, second time in however many episodes, we have a male on the show, which we don't do all that often. Y'all know Mishi. She came to me and she said, there's this person that you have to invite to be on the show. I think would be a really interesting conversation and really help solve some lingering questions that a lot of you guys have that we just don't answer on this show. So I would love to introduce Jay Feldman. He's a health coach, independent health researcher, and the host of the Energy Balance podcast, which, like, if you want to scramble your brain with like high level scientific kinds of conversations, go listen to that. But Jay, welcome to the show. Thank you for being here.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's an honor to be one of, I guess, two men on the show up till this point. So
yeah, it doesn't happen too often at all. But I have brought you on to talk about men, male health, kind of like the version of HA as it manifests in males and other kind of random questions that we have. But before we dive into that, would you mind kind of sharing about yourself, how you got into the work that you're doing and why this world is of interest to you at all?
Yeah, so I mean, as we get into the kinds of things that cause a similar situation in men, we'll dig into this, but I experienced to some extent some of those symptoms and issues. And so my history, I mean, I've always been really interested deeply in health and fitness. And so that was where my journey started, was trying to do everything I could to maximize my health, but also fitness and athletic performance. And that ended up taking me to a path of things like calorie restriction, a lot of exercise, eventually low carb diets and fasting and cyclical ketogenic diets. And at one point, vegetarianism and all the kind of different iterations in between. And at the conclusion of that part of the journey, I wasn't feeling, not only was I not feeling amazing, like I was promised, I wasn't feeling all that great. And I noticed that in terms of mood, in terms of energy, in terms of libido, in terms of sleep. And so, and beyond all that, I think the biggest one was the chronic intense hunger and restriction and cravings at that point as well. And so with all of those things together, I was ready and open for some sort of alternative, some sort of divergence from that path. And I came across what's called the bioenergetic view of health, which is the idea that the energy that our cells produce is the main determinant and driver of our health. And that really began to shift things for me. And I began to realize that so many of the things that I was doing not only were less than optimal, but were actually directly in opposition of my goals. And there was no surprise as to the fact that I was dealing with some of the symptoms I was dealing with. And so it really flipped things on its head. I completely changed the way I approached not only diet, but exercise and other aspects of lifestyle as well, as I'm sure we'll get into. And not only did that reverse some of those symptoms I was dealing with, but completely freed me from the chronic restriction that I was putting myself under. And I had recognized this notion that essentially every paradigm I had been dealing with was built on this idea that we need to fight against our bodies, you know, our natural urges, what we would want to do. All of those things are bad and make us sick and cause us to be unhealthy. And so we have to spend our lives and our willpower fighting against those. And so this new paradigm fully changed my perspective in that regard. And I realized that we actually want to work with our bodies, and our body signals are not the enemy. They're actually there for a reason. And so that really changed things. And I'm sure we'll be talking about that today.
I mean, I feel like that was 100% relatable and exactly what every single person. I'm actually really surprised to hear how many different things you actually have tried and done, like vegetarianism, all of the fast, like everything. You tried most of it. So that is actually like so far exactly the same as what a female has been through. So, okay. I find that really interesting. Okay. So what made you go into actual, like this as work? Like what kind of made you be like, oh, this is the path?
Yeah. Well, so my interest started when I was young, you know, maybe 13 years old or so. And so the goal at that point, or the only thing I was particularly passionate about, I mean, I guess I shouldn't say only, one of the main things or the things I was most passionate about was health and nutrition. And so I knew that it only made sense that that would be the arena I would pursue. I went to college pre-med and I was planning on becoming a medical doctor. And as I became inundated, not only with the kind of classes I was taking and their perspective, but also recognizing the confines of the typical medical approach or just the orientation of it, I realized that it really wasn't what I wanted. I think in the vast majority of cases is more of a symptom management approach, and among other things, was not what I was interested in. I wanted to actually help people regain their health. And so I decided not to continue down with that pursuit. I was going to do a PhD in research and realized again, you end up really zoning in on one, you know, particular pathway or mechanism and don't actually get to directly help people. And that was what I wanted to do. So I, you know, after I graduated, I just decided to do that directly and spent a lot of time doing a lot of research, writing articles and creating a podcast. And also I work with people one-on-one and in all sorts of different programs to help people actually regain their health. And I help both men and women with this. And you know, it's dealing with any sort of symptoms along the pathways we'll be talking about, all of the reproductive side of things, but also, you know, autoimmune issues and insomnia and I guess everything in between.
Yeah. It sounds like you went down a path of realizing that the medical field is quite like segregated. They really don't look at things holistically and from like actual, like everything's connected and but we're all relying on them. You know, like we have to check with our doctor who actually just has like a very small view of their specialty. But the approach you've taken as a health coach, you get to kind of look at the whole picture, which just impacts more people. So awesome. Okay. Well, let's dive in because I have questions. So this is like a good just kickoff. Obviously, HA in women is like a low energy availability issue. Manifests to us as a very clear and obvious. I mean, I feel like it's a clear and obvious sign that there's a problem when your cycle's missing. A lot of us miss that memo that matters, or even why that's happening. A lot of doctors are just like, that shouldn't be happening. Like your lab work is normal. So like you must have like a brain tumor. How does this show up in men? How, like when they're not getting that clear and obvious indication, how is this showing up in men and what's kind of the culture around it for men?
Yeah. So in terms of how it shows up, you're right. It's a lot less clear. And sometimes you can see it in lab work, you know, low testosterone, I'm sure something we'll talk about. And that's a way that it'll present. Although what's considered low nowadays, I think we could really expand that range, but I'm sure we'll talk about that too. But essentially, we do see the same depression of reproductive function in men as we do in women in the same instance of low energy availability. It's very, very parallel. And we just don't, you know, men don't have a cycle every month to kind of directly check in with, but we do have other things that we can try to check in with. And we do have to be a little bit more aware in that regard to be able to identify if it's a problem. And men tend to be a little bit less sensitive in this front, where it takes a lot more to see really clear symptoms, right? To get to a point where, you know, there's really low sperm count or something like that, or even really low testosterone, it can take a lot more. And we can talk about why that is as well. But in terms of presentation, it's not so uncommon, right? And so that would be things like low libido, low mood, depression can often be involved here as well, a lack of ambition, erectile dysfunction, difficulty building muscle or just having a lot more trouble building muscle or maintaining muscle, fatigue in general. And then also you do have things like the lab work where you could see low testosterone or, you know, maybe like a low sperm count or low sperm motility, those kinds of things as well. Those are all presentations of the same issue here, basically like hypogonadism, like low activity of the reproductive system.
You mentioned difficulty with muscle gain. And I know many, many men who are hard gainers or just like they take a week of vacation and everything's gone and they have to start again. And it's just extremely hard work. Is there kind of a difference between someone who is naturally a hard gainer and someone who is presenting as like having difficulty? Like, how do you differentiate between the two?
Yeah, so I don't know how much I subscribe to the idea that there are naturally hard gainers, right? I mean, there's definitely a spectrum. There's always going to be some variability between individuals for sure. And some people, body type wise, are going to be more likely to gain body fat and also gain muscle. And then there's the other side, but it still shouldn't be quite that hard. And there's a couple of really clear examples of this. So one, we have studies where they'll provide one group, well, it's actually two groups with testosterone. And then they have within the groups that get testosterone, one does resistance training, you know, works out, the other one doesn't. And then they'll have two other groups without the testosterone and one does resistance training, one doesn't. And guess which one produces the most muscle? Obviously, well, the one with testosterone and resistance training. But what's after the second one is the interesting one, which is that the group that produces the second largest amount of muscle is the group that doesn't work out at all, but is given testosterone. And they gain more muscle than the group that is working out without the extra testosterone. And we're talking about levels that are beyond normal in terms of testosterone in these sorts of studies, but it still is a really clear depiction of how much the hormonal state matters here when it comes to building muscle. And testosterone is an aspect of that. The counter side of that is cortisol and other stress hormones, which break down muscle and also make it a lot harder to gain muscle, and also happen to depress testosterone production and cause low mood and low energy and all of that. And so the hormonal state here cannot be overstated. It is huge when it comes to how well or not well or easily we can build muscle or whether we're hard gainers. And what we then have to decide is, outside of adding in a bunch of testosterone, how do we change the hormonal state so that we do naturally have lower stress hormones and higher reproductive activity and higher thyroid activity, which is also a factor there. And that then we start getting into all sorts of different aspects of nutrition, making sure we're eating enough carbohydrates and fats, and a number of other things that I'm sure we'll dig into. But I would essentially say that in most cases, hard gainers, and I was one of these, by the way, like I gained more muscle in months compared to years of what I was doing prior, just based on my hormonal state, how much I was eating and all the changes I made. You know, when I was doing the low carb and calorie restriction and I was in the gym all the time, I gained nowhere near as much muscle as after. So yeah, that's the gist of it.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Well, so I need to just fast forward straight to this testosterone question then. So for a couple of years now, I've just been hearing it everywhere, like, men just need to be taking testosterone. I'm like, I'm hearing it I feel a bit suspicious about it. So like, I'm curious about your, what you know, because I know almost nothing, but I'm just hearing like bros telling other bros, like, you should do like low dose testosterone, it'll help you with everything in your life. And like, in a way that they're like, there is absolutely no consequence. And I just feel like there's, everything has a consequence. So like, what am I not hearing, if anything? Or is it actually this like miracle idea?
Yeah. Well, no, you're spot on for sure. So just to take a second to zoom out, when we're talking about what is going to lead to low testosterone and high stress hormones and that set of things, we mentioned energy availability. And it's really important that we focus on that first. So if we don't have enough fuel, or we're not able to effectively convert that fuel, meaning food coming in, the substrate, especially fat and carbohydrates, if we don't have enough of those, and or we can't effectively convert it into energy, we're going to be in a low energy state. And our body senses that as something that's dangerous, right? That's not a time where we want to be focusing on expending a lot of energy, where we want to be reproductively fit, like where we want to be reproducing, because this is a time of famine. This is a time of excess stress, and generally not a situation that our bodies view as optimal. So it's going to naturally want to turn down its metabolic dial, which is typically considered to be our thyroid activity. So our thyroid activity goes down and our reproductive activity goes down and our stress hormones come up. And there's this whole confluence of signals that creates that state. And we see it at every level. So, you know, speaking of hypothalamic amenorrhea, you know, we have a very similar, I mean, the same axis essentially in men, where we have the hypothalamus and then pituitary and then gonadal axis. And you have the same depression there that happens, where cortisol is going to reduce GnRH production and then also reduce LH and FSH production and then also reduce testosterone production at each of those steps, at the hypothalamus and at the pituitary and at the gonads, at the testes. Cortisol blocks all of those things. And so that just tells us how impactful stress is. And then on the other side too, you have thyroid being implicated there as well, where thyroid is necessary for the actual testosterone production at the testes and helps to oppose the stress state. So that's kind of the big picture setting that we want to be considering, is that if we're in this situation, if we're dealing with any of those symptoms we mentioned, we're in a low energy state. Either there's not enough fuel coming in, or we're not converting it effectively to energy, or we're wasting too much with excessive exercise, or there's some other intense forms of stress, real like sleep deficiencies, you know, lack of sunlight, a lot of psychological stress. All those things will help contribute to this issue, you know, major gut issues, endotoxin production from bacteria in the intestines. All of those things will contribute to this low energy state. So now let's say we have somebody who's in that state. Their testosterone is not ideal and they're feeling it, right? The libido is not where it could be. They're not building muscle that well. They're prone to gaining body fat. They have low mood. They have they're just low energy. Everything is there. If we then want to throw a Band-Aid on it and help this person feel good quickly without considering the big picture, testosterone works, right? We can do that and we can provide testosterone for the rest of the life, the person's life at that point. But as you're kind of getting at, it's not actually resolving the underlying issues. And there's a potential cost to that. There's two that I would point to. One is just the actual kind of like danger of doing that, which is that testosterone can aromatize and be converted to estrogen. So if we're providing testosterone in a low energy environment that is tending towards stress and estrogen production in a man, it's very likely the testosterone will aromatize and we can get excess estrogen symptoms, which is typically not ideal. The other thing too is we want to consider that all these things are signals, right? It's just the hormones are just telling are just signals of how much energy we have available to use and where we want to focus, where we want to put that energy. If we're in a low energy state, we need to make sure that our heart is beating, our lungs are working well, our liver is okay, like our most vital processes. We're not going to be favoring reproduction. If we're in that state and we provide testosterone, that energy has to come from somewhere. And so we're essentially telling our body to prioritize muscle and sperm production and things like that over these other areas. And so we can potentially have issues in that regard, right? We're taking energy that we really don't have and allocating it to the wrong place. And that's
that sounds like a really big deal. Just like when women, it kind of sounds like a conversation we have a lot around when women with HA put their body in a headlock and force fertility treatment on, and then they have a baby, and sometimes the treatment causes like twins, you know, and then they go and have that baby and they breastfeed that baby and then they come out because they're like, I'm gonna deal with the problem later, I just want my baby now. You just put a massive amount of work on a body that was already saying absolutely not.
Mm-hmm.
You explaining it like that, kind of what it reminds me of, just like just forcing your body to like do something that it's saying it doesn't have what it needs to do.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's the exact same. And of course, for men, coming back to the reason why men are a little less sensitive, the needs for reproduction on the male side are not as intense as the needs on the female side, right? When we're talking pregnancy and the growth of the baby and then breastfeeding and all of that, energetically, there's much larger needs for females. But on the male side, we not only are there still needs, but also in a suboptimal environment, our bodies are not sensing that as a time where reproduction is good for all humans, like for the species, for us at the time. And so it's still a signal there. It's just not quite as strong for that reason. And so that's part of why men can often ignore these things or work through them, but they can still add up and come at a cost later on. And it's part of why men, I would say, we need to be really aware of how we're feeling and where our libido's at. And do we feel like we felt when we were in our 20s? How much has that changed? I would say so.
Save us all. Well, okay. So I mean, that was a really helpful answer. Thank you. I've been deeply curious about that. And I had a feeling you'd be able to explain it in a way that was like, oh yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Like that's straightforward. There just is no neutral. You can't just like put something in your body and have a neutral effect. It's so complex. We don't even understand, you know, the brain is the perfect chemist and we just like think we know better.
Hey, do you know what your blind spots are? As in, do you know what it is, what the thing is that is holding you back from getting your period back? Look, it could be an absolute plethora, cornucopia of things, but in our practice, the first place we tend to go is what behaviors and habits do you have around food that you may be still doing? And these are called blind spots because we just don't necessarily always know that they're an unhelpful habit or that it's something that we're doing, whether it be a subconscious or conscious need to control our food or our body, or whether it be something that you've just done for so long that it feels normal and like a preference even. We have created a checklist. It's a 3-page checklist that goes through food types, behaviors around food, and mindsets around food. And what you do is you go through the lists and you check off and you see which ones are you doing, whether it be daily, weekly, monthly, quarterly, and how are they potentially affecting your recovery today? So it's a really simple checklist. It's just 3 pages. You go through it. There's a very simple scoring system to help you figure out how much this may be impacting your recovery. And it's just an insightful thing for you to do to help you reflect, and then you can journal about it or you can learn more about it and just start really working at any of the boxes that you checked and understanding that they're playing a role in your recovery. So to get the checklist, all you have to do is go to thehasociety.com/blindspot and we'll send it straight through to you. You can print it off and you can check on it every now and then. I always recommend a reflection point every 4 to 6 weeks. How are you going? Are you still checking that behavior off, or have you, you know, systematically kicked it to the curb? So check it out. It's thehasociety.com/blindspot and it will be waiting for you there.
So I have a question about that too, right? I feel like every single day, people like us who are health practitioners of some kind, but we're not medical doctors, are always receiving intakes and new clients and things like that from people who have been truly let down by the medical system. My impression of this is just like we have it backwards and we're going to the doctors for the wrong things. And so like the doctors are not being set up for success because, you know, they're being asked to do something they're not really trained in. And we're all being told they should know better. And all of our clients are angry at their doctors. I would love to hear, because you just kind of have dabbled in all of like both sides, and especially in male healthcare, just kind of generally like broad strokes. What's your perspective on that? It's a broad question. Just like, are we too reliant on the medical profession in general for our overall health?
I like it. I like that perspective. It's really a good one, especially because as you're saying, it's not the doctor's fault that they're being put mm-hmm. in a position where someone is saying, I'm in this position, how do I reverse it, right? That's not in their toolkit, so to say. They're more so in a treatment type approach where if you are trying to get some outcome, like lower blood pressure, or in this case, fertility, here are the things we can do, kind of assuming you're not going to change anything else or fix what led to it in the first place, yes. right? That's not their orientation, is to consider why yes. that happened in the first place.
And to be clear, that's exactly why my question comes up. So that's good context. It's just like people are being told you cannot ovulate. Like, I don't think you'll ever be able to ovulate. So just come to me and we'll do Clomid, we'll do letrozole, et cetera. And it's like objectively incorrect. And there's also doctors, even though medicine is their scope, doing protocols that don't make a whole lot of sense for the actual problem that the person is dealing with. And that's kind of the context of my question.
Yeah. And obviously we're generalizing, yeah. Of course, there are some amazing medical doctors, but
yeah,
it's not, I mean, in kind of every single area it happens. And the more you learn about that system and then see how it's being treated, the more ridiculous it becomes that some of the things that are recommended are recommended. I think there's certain things that are great to go to a doctor for. I think helping to identify an issue sometimes can be really helpful, and getting lab work. And if you need a short-term fix, or again, coming back to TRT, not that most of the typical average medical doctors are suggesting it, but a lot of the, a lot of the ones that are, I guess, a little bit more hip these days are
functional medicine doctors and things.
Yeah, definitely. And And you know, so TRT is, I think, an example there where, for one, it's not the worst thing. I do want to preface that. I'm not saying like it should never be used, but it's definitely not solving the underlying problem. There are potential negatives to it that we talked about, and it's never the ideal long-term solution. It might be a part of a short-term solution, but it's never going to be the ideal long-term solution. And that's why, as well, there's this really common notion and an accurate one around TRT, which is that once you get on, you can't get off because your testosterone is going to tank. And that doesn't have to be true, but it's true in 99% of the cases because we're not fixing what led to the lack of testosterone in the first place. If you don't fix it and then you add testosterone and take it away, you're just going to be where you were before and then worse off because you've led to an even lower energy state in the process. If instead you're providing testosterone while fixing the root, while making sure to get good sleep and improve the energetic state in terms of nutrition and sunlight and all of the other factors that come in here, then you can get off of testosterone and actually maintain high levels. And I've definitely had clients do that. And that would be a situation where it's not the worst approach. It's still not the thing I would ever start with, because the other point to make is we can increase testosterone dramatically without just adding testosterone in. And that would be the ideal goal. But if we needed it for some reason, or we were already on it, we can still fix the underlying situation and get our own testosterone production going and improve our energetic state. So that way we can get off of it and not see this big drop. So yeah, I'm sure. Yeah, that's kind of my general perspective. I don't know if that fully answered the medical question, but.
No, yeah, cool. And could you replace, like everything you said, could you replace testosterone with like progesterone?
Of course.
A similar outcome. Where it's like, it can't, like there's a place for it, right? Like it can be helpful, especially maybe someone menopausal or postmenopausal or something like that. But it's not addressing the underlying problem if you become too reliant on it, but during like a transition of a healing phase.
Definitely, it's not fixing the underlying problem. We always want to consider that hormones are a reflection of the underlying state. So definitely, for women, I'm less hesitant to suggest progesterone versus testosterone for men. I think there are fewer negatives to it in terms of like, again, the testosterone with aromatization and that side of things. But for men, maybe if we're talking about something like pregnenolone or DHEA or a combination of those in low doses, which are basically precursors to testosterone and other steroid hormones, those I'd be a lot less hesitant to suggest in that Band-Aid kind of approach, or like in the process of healing things, but just trying to speed the process up a little bit. And so that's, I would think of progesterone as kind of a parallel there, where it can help a ton, especially if someone's dealing with some intense symptoms, you know, if there's really intense PMS or painful periods, or if we're trying to regulate the cycle a little quicker. But of course, as you're saying, we absolutely need to recognize that this is not fixing the underlying problem. It's just shortcutting us. And that shortcut can be a problem. It can be actually negative if we're not fixing the underlying issue. If we are, then it can maybe help us get there a little faster.
Okay. Yeah, cool. And now speaking of like kind of a right turn, speaking of the healing phase, a big part of what women with HA have an issue with is exercise, right? We're either dieting too hard or exercising too hard. And 90% of the time it's both. And a common approach that women take with HA recovery is, I'm going to just start eating more because I don't want to stop exercising. It's just a very fear-based approach, which is, I understand, I did the same thing. A lot of just difficulty understanding why you can't just always, I mean, for some people it's fine, but why you can't just always like go to what you should have been doing years ago and then like have your body catch up. Can you speak at all to the value of like physical rest in a world where it's like exercise like is so important, longevity, like if you don't exercise, all these bad things happen and it means a lot of bad things about you. So like, let's just like talk about exercise and rest in a more neutral way. Why the heck do we need to sit down when we're sick?
Yeah. So we've been talking a lot about energy, right? And there's two sides of that equation. We have our energy supply coming from the food that takes in and how well we take in and how well we use it. And then we have our energy demands. And those are everything that our body has to do that it uses energy for. And exercise is a huge one. And so if we're already in an energy deficient state, what we need to do is provide surplus energy. We need to have more energy supplied than demands. If we are adding exercise on, we're piling onto that demands, and that's coming at the cost of the energy we need for repair and regeneration and supporting our health to get out of the state, like to get out of the hole that we've dug, to get out of that metabolic debt that we've accrued. And that doesn't mean, as you're saying, it doesn't mean we don't want to move at all. We don't want any exercise at all necessarily, but we need to consider that this is directly taking from that same pool of energy that is going to be affecting our hormonal state and all the other areas too, you know, our skin health and our mood and all of that. So that would be the perspective I would take. And that's why it can be so problematic to still be pushing really hard in terms of exercise. It's just going to be draining that same pool of energy that we're, that it's the exact counter, you know, it's exactly counterproductive. If we're eating more, it'll at least maybe help to offset it. But if we're just even, if we're just in balance there and there's not extra energy, we're not going to be able to dig out of that hole. So that would be the bigger perspective I would have there. And the other thing I would say is when we're talking about the health benefits, the vast majority of health benefits are really just coming from not being sedentary. And that's something that we can accomplish without really a lot of exercise and without burning a ton of calories or using a ton of energy. And that just means that we're not sitting all day, that, you know, we're getting up and moving around and maybe walking around a little bit, even just activities of daily living, like, you know, gardening and cooking and cleaning, like just moving around the house is enough to not be sedentary. You know, as long as it's not just like that's 20 minutes of the day and the other 10 hours we're like sitting or laying down. But that's where the vast majority of benefits, when we're talking cardiovascular health and mortality and mood and everything, it just comes from not being sedentary. And so I would just say focus on that and just getting a little bit of movement in as opposed to exercise. And that can be a good replacement there.
Yeah. We even see very anecdotally, and all my colleagues as well, you know, have seen this. So I know it's not just me, that it's almost like there's a psychological component to just like that hold that the exercise has, that we could track your calories and look at your exercise and be like, you are objectively eating more and like this would be considered appropriate, but we're like, it's not budging. You know, like there is no ovulation, there is no cycle, it's not happening. And it's not until they let go of that thing they were holding onto. Like one example I have that represents a lot of examples is, you know, someone who was a part of our community for a really long time. So we weren't working one-on-one, but we would have kind of group calls and she would, you know, bring up her situation. And she eventually, it came out that she was still holding on to doing these, like this last piece for her, which was these planks that she would do first thing in the morning. She would get up out of her bed, she would do these planks, and then she would go and have her breakfast and live her life. And we were like, stop, you know, just try not doing it, see what happens. And, you know, she ovulated in like 2 weeks or something like that, like later. And it just happens all the time that there's obviously like the planks are not, you know, really destroying her energy availability issue. So there's something about like the hold that she has on her body and the level of control that she has on her body by continuing some semblance of exercise so that she doesn't completely lose her sense of self or like whatever the heck is happening. And when people finally like release that pinky finger of control, hormones respond. And that's crazy, but it happens all the time. Is there any like literature on this? Or is this just like, we're just seeing it happen?
I definitely don't know of any literature on it. I'm sure that
I don't know how they would do that, but.
Well, and they would have to attribute it to, there were some other changes that aren't being accounted for, blah, 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 blah. But I think there's definitely, of course, a psychological component. And I think you touched on the biggest piece there, which is control. And actually, I guess, letting go of what we're holding on to there. And that can be different things for different people. Like, why are we still exercising in that case? But I do think there's something to that, obviously. So,
yeah. Just curious if you've seen that in like a male population in particular, because it's very, very, it's like 80% of what we do is get people to just like stop.
Yeah, I haven't seen that, but it's tough as well because, again, there's not such a black and white. It's not like for men we're ovulating or not.
It's an
or
art.
We have our cycle
yes.
or not. Yeah, it's definitely an art. There's shades of gray, right? It's a spectrum for sure. And so it's probably a little harder to see those kinds of black and white changes. And I think there's also different levels to it. So for one, there are a lot of men who are restricting a lot in the aim of getting the six pack, right? I mean, that's, and I've fallen into that camp for sure. And I do think it's an underspoken for population, but I do think it is for most men dealing with some of the symptoms I mentioned, they typically aren't in as extreme of a deficit as a woman with HA in most cases. And so in most of those men that I'm helping, it isn't a case where we need to fully stop all exercise. And maybe they're just not as deep into that hole. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think the psychological component is huge for sure. And that is still there, right? Letting go of this control over your body and the essentially obsession with it, not to blame anybody, of course, like we can very easily look to culture for that, but
yeah.
Culture and society, but it's there for sure. And I know I experienced it without a doubt. And I do want to say also, just very briefly circling back, I had mentioned, progesterone in women dealing with symptoms menstrually. But again, if we're in a case where we have HA and there's not a cycle, I would also be wary of starting with progesterone for sure. I mean, I definitely wouldn't start with it. It's let's get all of the other underlying factors on board. Maybe there's a point to bring it in at some point later on. But yeah, definitely, just like with testosterone, the solution is not we see low T, so we replace the testosterone, right? And that's the medical model, but there's all those costs with it, as we were describing.
So. Yeah. I mean, putting someone with HA on progesterone just seems nonsensical. It's like, and most of them don't pop. Most women won't bleed from it anyway with HA. You know, it's like actually maybe like 2 out of 10 people will actually pass the progesterone challenge. And occasionally we will find someone who has just been put on it every month. And that's like the solution. So that's really interesting. But you had briefly said, like really quick, which I have a question about, men kind of going through these types of similar issues don't always have to make such drastic lifestyle changes. Like they will continue with some kind of exercise. This is the thing. We look at our partners and we're like, why didn't they have to do this stuff that we have to do? Like, you know, why don't they have to eat as much? Why does it seem to be all right for men to skip more meals or train as much as they want? And why is it so difficult for us to compare ourselves to that? So can men just kind of like, we are just way more sensitive and men can just like, what's going on? Why are you so different?
Well, I think there's a difference in presentation, but not necessarily a difference in the main parts of the physiology. Obviously there are differences physiologically, but there's a reason maybe why women live longer, like on average. And what I'm trying to get at is for men, the presentation might not be as intense gonadally, right? In terms of libido and sperm production and motility and all of that. But that doesn't mean that there's not still a cost. And maybe we see that cost more in cardiovascular issues or, other related symptoms. But there's still no, we're talking earlier, there's no free lunch for sure. And so men doing intermittent fasting and low carb can often get away with it a lot longer, or over-exercising, all those things. But that doesn't mean that they're actually getting away with it. It just means that the symptoms and issues take longer to present and it's not as easy to connect them directly. But I would say these sorts of things are just as important for men as they are for women. It's just not as clear in terms of the presentation. Or obviously, I think there are some differences like culturally in terms of like the idea of pushing through any sort of negative feelings and burning the candle at both ends types of things that of course apply to women too, but for men as well. I think there's a lot of cases like that where we're taught to ignore, if the energy is low, we push through it or take whatever pre-workout supplement or, all those kinds of things. And there's still a huge cost to that. It's just not, I think it's just not talked about as much.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's why we're here. When you work with women, do you use the menstrual cycle as a tool?
Yeah, of course. I mean, it's one of the benefits, right? Is you have some clear signs and it's like a, not like a blood test every month, but it gives us, it gives us information every month or every couple of weeks, you know, every week, depending on how things are changing in terms of where we're at metabolically. And that's really valuable information.
Do you wish men had a menstrual cycle that you could use?
Yeah, I guess so. I don't know what that might look like, but
more data is always good. Some kind of version of it, you know?
Yeah.
I could come up with some, but what do you do? Okay, cool.
Yeah. Well, but again, that, just to mention on the men front, you know, we do have signs and symptoms that we can tune into, right? It just, we have to.
What are they? Yeah, tell me. Tell me like what we should all go and tell our significant others to be looking out for.
Yeah, well, and I mentioned it earlier, like comparing ourselves to when we were in our 20s, right? The reason for that is because it's hard. Sometimes it's hard to recognize the day-to-day changes or the month-to-month changes or year-over-year changes because it's slow and gradual. But do we have the same libido and sex drive that we did at that point? Do we have the same energy and ambition? You know, are we waking up ready to go and like take on the day and have great energy, or are we relying on stimulants to do so? Do we have to drink coffee all the time? How's our digestion? Like how easily can we maintain our body composition? You know, it should be easy and effortless if we're eating well and properly, so to speak, but are we finding that we have to, you know, restrict what we're eating during the week to make up for the weekends, or do we get bloated now? Is it really easy for us to gain weight now? And those kinds of things I think are so common. It's just considered to be a part of like aging, so to speak, but
and they happen almost so slowly that you're not immediately aware of them. Like you would actually have to sit down and reflect and be like, oh, all those things are happening to me, but you wouldn't actually notice because it's happening so progressively over time.
Yeah. Yeah. Most of the time, most men are not aware of it until they have some other issue like high blood pressure or some version of insulin resistance or some other presentation of problems. And then we get to it from that perspective. But it's just considered normal, right? For those things to change, so to speak, over time, as opposed to us to maintain a good, healthy, vibrant self.
Yeah. Yes, yes. You mentioned blood pressure too. So it's a common trait for women with HA to have low blood pressure. And you go to the doctor and they're like, oh, you're so healthy. Like super impressed with your blood pressure. And we're all really proud of it. Is this the same thing with men? Well, that's just kind of like down regulation of everything. Present as low blood pressure too.
I mean, on the like spectrum of stress, initially we'll have the stress response, like elevated stress hormones that are supposed to create an effect. So if we have, let's say, low testosterone, we should then have a reflexive increase in GnRH and then in LH and FSH that will get produced, and then we should have good testosterone production and sperm production as a result. But then over time, if let's say there are further metabolic issues, then we don't have those results. Like we're not actually able to get that effect. And then eventually you have the downregulation of the whole system. Like that's one of the last presentations, and then everything is low, right? It's like the extreme chronic version. And so many men are going to like symptoms will come about even if we're not at the full end of that spectrum. And that's where you can still see, you know, you'll see things like high blood pressure over time. I've never really seen, I've worked with a couple of men that are like fully like not producing sperm and things like that, but it's so rare for it to get to that extreme level.
Yeah.
That it's hard for me to like make a generalization there as far as like, let's say something like blood pressure.
Yeah. Cool. Just curious. Like I really just haven't gotten to ever pick anyone's brain about men. So I really appreciate that. We're pretty much at the end of our time. I don't want to keep you for too much longer. I believe this was really helpful. I'm going to ask the ladies in the audience to let me know. And if there was just like a question that they're absolutely livid, I didn't ask, can't believe I didn't go there. Let me know. And I can hassle Jay and see if I can get him to come back and answer more questions for us. But this was great. I think we got a great idea of what to look out for in men, why and how we can stop being so butthurt, feeling like they don't have this kind of problem. And just like, I think that, it's not just women. We just, as a whole society, need to be keeping an eye out for this rubbish everywhere. I mean, I'm always coming across men talking about like the crazy stuff they're doing. And I just kind of want to tell them, like, oh, I don't think that makes a lot of sense. But there's a part of you that just thinks, like, don't say anything. He's a man, you know? So I really appreciate that. And I think that this has been really enlightening for a lot of people. I really appreciate it.
Good. Well, yeah, I hope so. And yeah, I think in many ways, women are the canaries in the coal mine in that regard, right? It's like, it's not that these things aren't really problematic. They are, the cold plunges, the fasting, all of that. It's just as much of a problem for men. It just takes a little bit longer to present. And it can be slow and so graded that it's hard to identify, but it's happening. We're not different
Yes.
species here. So, yeah.
Yes. I feel validated. Thank you so much. Okay, to close out, would you mind telling everybody like where you would, if they just want to nerd out more and hear more about you, talk about everything in minute detail, where can they go to do that?
Yeah, well, so we talked a lot about the signs and symptoms and physiology, but in terms of some of the practical places to start, I think one of the easiest places is with making some changes dietarily and choosing the foods that are going to best support us metabolically, make sure that we are producing energy efficiently. And so I have a food guide designed to help people do exactly that. So listeners can head over to jfeldmanwellness.com/guide to download that food guide. And otherwise, I have a podcast called the Energy Balance Podcast. I have, free articles and podcasts on my website and links to everything at jfeldmanwellness.com. So that's where I'd recommend people head.
Perfect. Thank you so much, Jay. This has been great, and I hope that you have a great day.
Yeah, Danny, thanks so much for having me.
Hey there, it's me, Danny, and I want to tell you about the Temp Drop as a fertility awareness method tracking option. So many of you guys know that we actually recommend the fertility awareness method both as you're going through recovery and 100% after you have gotten some cycles back and you're starting to move forward for the rest of your reproductive years. So Temp Drop itself is a wearable fertility monitor, and we love it. It's a wearable device, so you put it around your arm and you can use that instead of taking your temperature manually with a thermometer each morning. So I'm personally a big fan of the manual tracking. All of us at the HA Society are, and that's the method that we use, just using a good old thermometer. We use that with our clients because it's the best way to use it as a diagnostic tool as a practitioner. And it's also the best way to ensure if you're trying to avoid pregnancy that you don't get pregnant. However, manual temping for many reasons is just not always an option. When you're in the middle of recovery, again, we do recommend manual temping, but once you're cycling, the temp drop is actually a really great hack. So it gives you basically everything you need to effortlessly track your fertility status, like where you are in your monthly cycle. So you wear the temp drop sensor while you're sleeping for accurate basal body temperature readings without the stress of early morning wake-ups. So I personally love this because with a toddler, my wake-up times are all over the place, and the occasional sleep disruptions make using an oral thermometer a lot more difficult. So, Temp Drop's accompanying charting app enables you to track an array of symptoms alongside your basal body temperature. This includes tracking your cervical mucus if you've been using OPKs, and then it also gives you sleep insights too. So, you can combine these fertility signs all in one place, and that will help you identify your fertile window, confirm ovulation, plan for your period, and if you're trying to get pregnant, identify whether or not you are pregnant. So whether you're trying to conceive or avoiding pregnancy, or you want to chart for health reasons like HA recovery, making sure your cycle's not slipping back in the HA direction, Temp Drop makes fertility awareness accessible to all women, even if you don't have regular cycles or sleeping patterns. So track your ovulation in real time with the Temp Drop,
And we are lucky enough to have a 15% off code. So if you go to their website, they're usually having a sale, but you can stack this code on top of the existing code. So just go to tempdrop.thehasociety.com and use the code AFHASociety. I think too, if you just go to tempdrop.com and use AFHASociety at the checkout, that will work too. So happy temping and good luck. This episode is brought to you by Grassland Nutrition Beef Liver Capsules. Did you know that in terms of nutrient density, beef liver actually blows vegetables and fruits out of the water? If you're a client of mine, you have already been instructed to eat beef liver either fresh or in capsule form. I recommend it for anyone and everyone who is, of course, dealing with amenorrhea and fertility challenges out there, but I may even recommend it for just everyone in general. Get your husbands on it, get your partners on it. If you have a history of HA and add on top of that maybe a history of the pill, maybe you've been pregnant before, you know, through treatments or other, like you've just, your body's been through anything, you know, you're absolutely 100% dealing with a nutrient deficiency of some kind. And while it's true that testing is going to be the best way to understand those exact deficiencies, eating nutrient-dense, real food is going to be one of the most important next steps that you take with or without testing. So I've been using and recommending Grassland Nutrition Beef Liver Capsules for years now, and the capsule form makes it so easy to get your liver in every day, and I appreciate the transparency of this product in particular above others. So in case you're wondering, it's completely natural. This is freeze-dried beef liver in capsules. It's organic, it's made from Australian beef, and my favorite of their products is the liver with kelp because of the iodine from the kelp, which is important for overall thyroid function, which is often low in women with underperforming hormones. So rather than eat seaweed snacks every day, I get to take this beef liver with the kelp for my iodine. So if you're recovering or working on a fertility journey right now, do not skimp the nutrient rich source of beef liver. Get 10% off your order with the HA Society and support your favorite podcast along the way. They ship to most countries, so you should be covered. Just go to grasslandnutrition.net and use HA Society, just HA Society, at the checkout for the 10% off. That's grasslandnutrition.net with the code HA Society. Thank you so much for listening today, guys. Please subscribe to the podcast, and if you could head to iTunes specifically and leave a rating or review, that would help so much because it makes it easier for other people with HA who are Googling around to find the podcast really easily. So if you do that, you're doing a service to all of the women.